Good morning to you all.
Good morning, Maurice.
This is the 24th annual celebration of our wedding day, and we're so delighted to have you all at the party. And therefore, another justification for the kind of focus that we have today. Just very briefly, what we're up to is this book by John Updike, Marry Me. I think it's his most recent, am I right? I think this is the latest thing that he's written. That doesn't make it all that new. Let me see, 71. He writes slow like I do. What we hope to do with this book, however, is springboard from it. Those of you who are interested in either John Updike or in matrimonial carryings on might like to purchase this if and when it ever arrives in the bookstore and read it. It's an excellent book. I teach a course at our seminary on marriage and family and marriage counseling, and I intend to make them all read it because it is so good as far as describing the ins and outs of what goes on between married people. I think old Updike's got a good eye for that sort of thing. That's what makes him a good novelist. And he puts his good eye to very good use in this book. So, we hope to springboard from this to discussions not just of relationships between married people, but relationships in general. Maybe even between unmarried people. There's some of that going on in here too. But to lead us into that just a bit, to give us a theological undergirding for where we're going, I want to bring to mind just a couple things from Genesis. First of all, that little section where it says, we are made in the image of God. And now I have to watch myself with Ralph because I might be trampling on his toes. They tell me at my school I'm all right. The exegetes tell me at my school that I'm on safe ground. Is it thinkable that part of the image of God is that God is several and yet one? We talk all that funny talk, you know, about three and one, and if you've ever read the Athanasian Creed, you know it just goes round and round and round and says, one is one and one is three, but yet three is one and three is not one and one is not three, and it just plays with those numbers like you think you're back in first grade learning to add, but can't quite make it. But that idea, which I find, if not expressed, at least, hinted at, in the plurals that are used for God in Genesis 1, let us make man in our image, plurals, okay? And part of that image is that, like the Holy Trinity, which is a much later idea, okay? Like the Holy Trinity, we are looking for unity with others. And that this is a lifelong search. I didn't blow anybody's mind yet. That it's not just something we do casually, that there happen to be other people around, and therefore, because there are other people around, we have to relate with them. We can do things more easily. You know, if you're trying to carry a telephone pole, it helps to have one guy on each end. And so we can do things together that we couldn't do alone, and therefore we relate to each other. To all of that, I say, no, there's more to it than that. It's because that's part of the image of God that is there in us. Now, you might want to fill out image of God with all kinds of other ideas, but start with this one today with me, that we seek a unity with others. Because that's how we're wired. That's how we are created by God, to seek a unity with others. One place where that unity finds a very full sort of expression is in marriage. But that ain't the only place it finds expression. It finds expression in friendship, in working relationships, in Enemies, it finds its expression all over the place. To have contact, to have something going on with another person, to be drawing close, to be building some oneness. Think about the best friend you have. The best friend you have, or think about a whole series of best friends, as Jeanette was the other night in chapel, and what you notice is a oneness develops with a best friend, doesn't it? Some approach of that even develops with an acquaintance. And if you're not ready to call somebody an acquaintance, what's the next step down? I guess, you know, somebody I see every once in a while. You know, the guy who hangs on the next strap on the bus right next to you every day and you get to know him that way. That's not even an acquaintance. You don't exchange names, but something begins to develop. You begin to know something about that person. He begins to know something about you. And there is some building of unity there, even in that very passing kind of contact. So that's the thought. Then, what seems to get in the way of the building of that unity, and that's what we want to focus on these next 2 days. The clinkers that get stuck on the grate, or the roadblocks, or the barbed wire that we string across things to that effectively keeps others out. And the one that shows up in this book is differences between people. Well, you know, gee whiz, he's old and I'm young, or I'm old and he's young, or he's black and I'm white, or you know, those kinds of differences, which sort of jump out at us and we're very aware of them. I had the experience a while ago, well, it's been a couple of years, a kind of, you know, aha experience for me. I was sitting in at a stoplight, and there was a guy crossing in front of me. And this is summertime in St. Louis, so the window is open and I'm hot. And this guy's coming right in front of my car. And he gets about here. And then I noticed him, and he was, he seemed to be an alcoholic. A man, I would guess, about my age, but black, very shabbily dressed, staggering in the street in front of me. I instinctively reached over and cranked up the window. I was afraid of him. And then my conscience got the better of me, and I said, why on earth are you afraid of that poor soul? You know, you could probably even lick him, little as you are. I was afraid of him, I decided, because his love for himself was very, very obviously different from my love for myself. Okay, I wash, I put on clean clothes, I even shave sometimes, I keep myself in good shape. When I am intoxicated, I try not to stagger around in the street. And here it was, you know, early morning, and that's the shape he's in. What was frightening me about him was the way in which he was different from me. How can I possibly predict what he's going to do next? Crank up the window. You know, he might come over and what? Pull me out of my car. I don't think he was well enough coordinated anymore to do that. What could he do to me? He could spit on the window even after I cranked it up and do about as much damage as if he had spat on me. There's nothing for me to be afraid of, but I was afraid of him because he was so different from me. And that's where a lot of it comes from, differences. Let's dig into the book a little bit, unless you want to fire some of that back at me. Let me say again, as I said earlier, and maybe you didn't all hear it because it was last week, we prefer to teach dialogically. So anytime you've got something to say, please say it. Don't wait for an invitation, right? Please say it. That's the way things are at our house. We get interrupted all the time, isn't that right? Okay. If you have anything, just pitch it in. The book.
Paul told you that he teaches a class in marriage, and we also run marriage enrichment workshops around the country. And we did one recently in Denver area. And people who come to our marriage enrichment workshops are supposed to have good marriages to begin with. In fact, if we have any way of finding out, if, you know, if the pastor has referred them and it's because their marriage is in trouble, we say, gee, if you live in St. Louis, it might be nice if you saw Paul privately, but marriage enrichment isn't designed for troubled marriages. And the people in Marry Me would not qualify for our marriage enrichment workshops. If we knew about their troubles, we would say, don't come, because the two marriages that are described in this book are in pretty tough shape. There are two main couples. I suppose the number one couple is Jerry. The man is Jerry. His wife's name is Ruth. I feel like I related more to them than to the other couple, and I suppose everybody would. Jerry and Ruth live in a small town on the East Coast somewhere. I don't remember exactly where. A nice town. Everyone does very well. And they live in a nice house and have a couple cars and, you know, all those kind of things. And Sally and Richard do too. In fact, they're good friends. They travel in the same groups. Their children go to school together. They've each been married, 1 8 years and 1 10 years. And they've known each other ever since they've lived in this town together. Jerry, who's kind of the main character of the book, is a Lutheran. John Updike always has a few Lutherans in his book because...
They're a very gloomy lot, though. deeply troubled people.
John Updike's father was a Lutheran minister, and so he always has a few Lutherans floating in and out. And his wife is now congregational, although she started out as a Unitarian. Her father was a Unitarian pastor, and that the church does not mean nearly as much to her as it does to John. I mean, to Jerry. John in there, he's not in the book. The church means a great deal. Sort of. You'll see as we go along. It's a strange kind of relationship with the church, but he wants his children to be sure to go to Sunday school. It isn't so important whether he goes to church or not, but his children have to go to Sunday school, and his children have to be baptized. It doesn't matter whether he goes to communion or not, but his children must be baptized. And so he has a lot of those things going. And the story has 1, 2, 3, 4 chapters. Okay. Kind of, you find out later on, but early on, sort of before chapter one, Ruth, of the Jerry and Ruth couple, okay, had an affair with Richard, of the Sally and Richard couple. And it only lasted a short time, and it wasn't very important to either one of them, and Ruth cut it off because she almost got caught. And she's really kind of the two women anyway, she's kind of holier than Sally is, but still she's the one who had this early affair. Then the book starts out with Sally and Jerry are having an affair. And this is how the book begins. And the first chapter is all about a weekend that they spend together in Washington, D.C. He's going there on business. She decides to follow him so that they can be together. And that's the main gist of chapter one. They seem to love each other very much, but they both have a spouse at home.
And a passel of kids.
And yeah, they each have three kids. And however, due to a lot of things that happen airplane-wise, they are very late returning. And by the time they return, Jerry has decided that he is going to tell Ruth about Sally, and he's going to ask whether she will give him a divorce. And so chapter two is the reacting of Ruth. And Ruth comes off rather level-headed and says, you know, it's the beginning of the summer. Let's wait through the summer, and if you'll stay home and kind of do nice things with the children and make sure that you don't love me anymore, and if you still feel at the end of the summer that you love Sally more than you love me and the children, then we'll reconsider it at the end of the summer, but you have to promise me you won't see Sally through the summer and that we'll have a good summer together. And Jerry says,
I'm going to show you how to interrupt Jeanette. You just say, tum, tum, and then she starts talking. What what is somewhat intriguing about the character of Jerry is he has just a terrible time trying to make up his mind. He's a good Lutheran, you know. He lusts like the rest of the world, but then he can't really make a final move about it. He's got to come almost as a little boy to Mama. He comes to Ruth and says, "I've got this terrible problem, and I wish you would really help me make up my mind about it." Isn't that almost the flavor that it has?
Sort of. He wants her to agree with what he's going to do. He doesn't want to do it unless she's happy about it. And she's very happy about it. And so so he's willing to agree to this summertime arrangement. And during the course of the summer, they see Sally and Richard occasionally. They aren't such close friends anymore. The couples aren't such close friends as they were. And
does she tell her husband?
She hasn't yet. Okay, that's the next chapter. And Ruth has not told Jerry, couple number one, about Richard. Okay. At some point, she tells him that she had an affair recently, but she doesn't ever tell him who it was with. And Richard is kind of a gadfly, and everybody knows he's had lots of affairs. So whether or not anybody knows that he had one with Ruth, I don't believe that anybody ever finds it out. But he's really, it helps to know their business a little bit too. Richard's father owned a chain of liquor stores, and he inherited those along with a lot of money, and he's dabbling in all kinds of businesses, and so he's always flying around going somewhere and doing something, and he seems to make money without even half trying. He goofs off a lot, but they're never wanting Sally and Richard. And Jerry started out in art school, and when he got into the business world, he thought he was going to make it in cartooning, but he wasn't successful. And so now he's making television commercials, and he has been very successful at that. He does the animation for television commercials. And so they're all living very well, and neither one of the women work, and they both still have children that are not in school. One is about 4, Ruth's youngest, and Sally's youngest is about 2.
Notice how Updike is so clever, I think, in writing for Lutherans. You immediately disliked Richard, didn't you? After all, he is well-to-do, but he didn't earn it. He inherited it, the rascal. And furthermore, he makes money without working for it, you know, just by investing it or doing something that always looks shady to us Lutherans. And then his inherited wealth comes from selling booze to people. What a terrible way to get it.
And another part of that, he's supposed to be very handsome, big, kind of tough guy, but he has one false eye. And they're always talking about how this one eye isn't looking where the other one is or something or another, you know, and they make a big thing out of it. I'm not sure why. But so again, even though he's the big, strong, handsome guy, he certainly has some flaws.
And Jerry, on the other hand, you know, high aspiring little Lutheran fellow who goes to art school and wants to be a great cartoonist and has all the shattering dismay of learning that he can't do that, and then he ends up working hard as an animator and idea man for TV commercials of all things. You know, who couldn't sympathize with him?
So during the course of the summer, Sally is feeling very depressed, and she takes off for Florida with her children. And Richard knows that something's wrong, but he doesn't really know what, and he doesn't care particularly. And as the summer draws to a close, and Jerry's going to have to make up his mind soon what he's going to do, Sally returns, and they see each other at a party and some things like that. But at any rate, finally Sally does tell Richard. And Richard has a big scene, you know, just way more than you expect Richard ought to after listening to the first part of the book. But he calls up, it's night, and he wants Jerry and Ruth to come over right away and says they have to sit down and talk about this, and they have kind of a shouting session. And that's sort of the third chapter then, the reacting of Richard, his emotional stuff. And then the last chapter I'm not going to tell you about, because I really do hope that you'll read it sometime. And it's not just, I don't know if I can tell you how it turns out. To be honest with you, after I read the last chapter, I wasn't sure how it turned out. And I think you ought to read it too, and if you're interested in the storyline, you can put together the bits and pieces of information. What we're going to deal with today is what got in the way of their relationships, and we're going to read a little section, and then we hope you'll all participate in the discussion.
So, who reads the first section?
You do.
I get the first one. Okay. The first difference we lift out for your inspection between these people has to do with a difference between Jerry and Ruth, and it lands right close to home. It has to do with a difference in attitude towards religion and importance of God. Let me read you a short section. The baptism of the children became a sore point. The first, Joanna, was christened by Ruth's father in their first apartment on 12th Street. Jerry had been shocked by the ceremony, you will be too, which seemed to him a parody of the sacrament. His father-in-law, a civic-minded man active in the interracial councils of Poughkeepsie, no, that's not right, but you know, that funny town in New York, had joked about holy water as he was drawing it from the kitchen tap. This man is a Unitarian minister, recall. So the next child, a boy, was baptized as a Lutheran in the dour country church smelling of apple blossoms and moldy velvet, where Jerry, as a boy, had been confirmed. The score thus tied, notice, the third child hung 2 years above the mouth of limbo while his parents fought to a standstill on behalf of their heritages. Ruth was surprised by their passion. She had put religion behind her. Having been obliged to attend church automatically as a girl, she felt faint, guilty, and disoriented whenever she entered a church now. Just one stanza of a hymn would make her voice falter, and by the third stanza she was fighting tears, while the organ thundered at her like a pompous, hurt father. Whereas Jerry, defeated in his ambition to become a name cartoonist, and immersed with their move to Greenwood in the organic and the mediocre and the familial, suddenly dreaded death. Only religion helped. He read theology, Barthes, Marcel, Berger. He taught the children bedtime prayers. Each Sunday, he deposited Joanna and Charlie in the Sunday school of the nearby congregational church, sat through the sermon, and came home cocky and ready to fight. Interesting effect of worship for him. He hated Ruth's pale faith, which receded and evaporated still further under his hatred. There was a goodness she did feel, a diaphanous truth and excellence floating in the world like the dust of buds in the elm outside their bedroom window. Otherwise, we must not hurt others deliberately, and we should take pleasure in each day, and that was it. That was her religious faith. Wasn't it enough? Once wakened from sleep to hear him protest that someday he would die, Ruth had said, dust to dust, and rolled over and gone back to sleep. Jerry never forgave this. She regretted it, and when he lay in bed staring at the ceiling, and when he moved through the midnight house as if his whole body were sore, fighting for breath, he's asthmatic, by the way, she could not enclose his terror and withdraw it from him as she did his seed. The child's non-baptism tormented him as a face of his own extinction. Ruth pitied and yielded. Jeffrey was baptized in his father's arms while she stood beside in a borrowed hat, vowing never to attend church again, trying not to cry. Now, you see a difference, a religious difference between these two. What do you notice of religious differences as barrier to relationship for you? Any relationship.
In that situation, the difference is, it's really superficial all the way through. Like, they have these differences, but they don't use their faith or use their faiths. They have or don't have, they just fight about the name.
He's saying she doesn't have any.
Yeah.
And she's saying his is pretty kooky, you know, funky, obsolete.
But she has beliefs. you know, about.
Yeah.
And, you know, you.
How might she use it? How might she use what she has to get them past this difficulty? I ask the hard question. It's a very difficult question to ask a group of Christians, isn't it? Because we feel an obligation to be a witness. A rather sizable obligation to be a witness. Once again, the question, how does differences in religious attitudes and belief become a barrier between people? What's your experience with that one?
I guess usually we're so busy in witnessing to our own faith that we really aren't listening to what the other person is saying.
Beautiful, yes. Yes. We're so busy at times being concerned about getting the faith, huh, across to these poor unbelievers that we fail to recognize what the first speaker recognized, Eric, right? What Eric was recognizing, that both these people do have some beliefs. And they're pretty busy poo-pooing each other's. Yeah.
I think we all have a problem with stereotyping people or being stereotyped ourselves, so that you have a problem again moment.
That's what they're doing to each other, isn't it? Ruth is saying of Jerry, her husband, well, you know, he's a funky Lutheran. He's got these ideas about heaven and hell. He's got these ideas about sacraments. He thinks a baptism makes a difference. Crazy idea. Huh? And what's he saying about hers? Up next word is diaphanous faith. You hold up to the light and see right through it. Doesn't amount to much.
Well, this is a personal reminiscence. It was quite different. I'm thinking of my mother, first of all, who, when she heard my sister and brother-in-law having this spat, simply said to my sister, my sister told me, said, well, you just don't ever talk to your husband that way. That was quite a very good marriage between my mother and father. And the second thing is that, as pastor German Russians, in South Dakota town, which everybody wanted in my parish, except, and went to a parochial school, except one child, and I said, as a young pastor, who in the world, doesn't that boy go to our school? The whole family is Lutheran. And he said, but the father's not. And then they said, they had a German proverb, nicht zwei Glauben auf einem Kissen. You can't have two faiths on one pillow. And that meant that the marriage relationship was more important than all these personal ideas. And I think they were much wiser than the young pastor. I mean, I never pushed that. But somehow or other, that's the opposite, you see that? They weren't pushing imperialistically.
Yeah.
She married that guy. She very well knew, and the whole community knew, and respected the fact that that boy who brought up in that case was kind of a revivalistic congregational church. Since that was it, the hands off, no question. Which actually was kind of a nice thing. You knew where you were living, you didn't have to fight that out on the marriage.
It did not become a barrier to their relationship because it was abundantly clear.
It was very traditional, conventional people.
But they were honoring each other's stand.
Yeah, I don't know what went on just between them. I think they had a good relationship. But that was kind of the ethos of the whole community.
Uh-huh.
It's interesting. Our oldest son has been going with a Jewish girl for about 3 or 4 years, and I love her dearly. She's just a fantastic person. And in the beginning, my whole stance was, you know, to get her into the Lutheran Church. And every time there was a chance, I invited her to come along. Now I leave it up to her. If she says to me, "Gee, it's Christmas and you've always asked me to come along on Christmas," she isn't. Well, I don't know how to say it. Her parents are Orthodox Jewish people who do all the things, except they don't attend the synagogue very regularly, but they do all the food stuff and everything. And religion, her own religion, doesn't mean a great deal to her. But I've been having just a struggle trying to decide at what level I come in on this, you know. I mentioned this yesterday in a group, so you know, it's something I'm thinking about. After a discussion at school on the whole Holocaust and so forth, decided that the best thing is to, by my example, be somebody special that she would like to be like, and then say, "Why do you act like that?" You know, and then from that standpoint, have her come to me and say, "What is different about being a Christian?" If they get married, and I'm sure they will one of these days, I hope they do one of these days, I think I would respect her no matter what she chooses to do, but in my heart of hearts, I still hope she'll become a Christian. It's a touchy situation. It doesn't seem to be very touchy to her. She's, you know, she's not upset by it, but causes me problems.
Well, I think it would be even more difficult for the wife. Okay, she's looking at her husband's religion, thinking it's kooky. And especially if he attends a worship service and comes home ready to fight.
He doesn't go to the Lutheran worship service, and he'd probably come home ready for Holocaust, huh? But he goes to the Congregational Church and comes home ready to fight. Cocky and feisty, we would say.
I mean, if you look at somebody's religion and you think it's strange, anyway, and then if they come home with this attitude, then you're really, you know, just as soon not have anything to do.
Part of it, he's taking the kids to her church and going himself.
Some of the other times he doesn't stay. He just drives them off and figures that's an important contribution.
Parental duty.
He never does say why he doesn't go to his own church. Maybe there isn't one in that town. Because it doesn't make any issue of that. Well, maybe the congregational thing was just something that they settled on together. You know, it's been a while since I read this. Maybe that was how she...
Well, it's very clear. She doesn't want to go to church. It bugs her to be there. It brings up all kinds of bad stuff from her earlier life.
Experience that I have with students at Augie who are contemplating a mixed marriage is that they don't really see it as an issue. But they get a hold of the grandparents and they find it's very much of an issue. Turns out not to be a personal issue. Turns out to be a family issue. Particularly if it's a Roman Catholic family that is an early 20th century immigrant, Polish, Italian, and they're trying to keep the family together. And then you bring in some American Protestant or even Swede, and then they're going, I had one this spring particularly interesting, he was a Roman Catholic at Wisconsin Synod. So I said, when they asked me, how do we look at this? I said, we're going to find some raw emotions here. Why don't you start out by talking to the clergy of the respective faiths?
So it'd be raw emotion there, too.
So the Roman Catholic went to see the Wisconsin Lutheran and found out that she was going to hell because she didn't hold the pure doctrine. And then the Roman Catholic went, and then the Wisconsin Synod went to see the Roman Catholic and found much more compassion and interest there in that particular instance. But it's when the students have done this and they come back to me, they wish they'd never started it. Because what they didn't see as a problem all of a sudden looms as an enormous problem. And they were convinced before they could have worked this out after they were married. And now they begin to wonder if in order to marry, if they're going to have to break from their families entirely. If they're not, break from them, simply be outcast. But it's not so much a matter of faith as it's a matter of the cultural identity of the family.
And a very careful keeping of score.
Mm-hmm.
Huh?
Yeah.
that the clergy frequently participate in as well.
As far as my son's friends' parents are concerned, first of all, they're much older. They're older than my parents are, so that puts a generation gap between us and them. And they're not so concerned about the religion. It's a strange thing, but I don't know how many Jewish people you know, but they're just frightened of the fact that he's a non-Jew, you know, and that the whole cultural thing is going to blow. And they feel so threatened anyway by the whole melting of cultures in the United States, and they want to keep that so separate. Now, they have become more friendly lately, but the first 2 or 3 years were just out-and-out warfare. And now they've learned to like him, which helps. And they found out that he isn't just a horrible person, which they had built up in the beginning.
Anybody got any thoughts about a way around this, please?
Is it possible that, I mean, when you were talking about the Myron is saying about advising them to go to their respective pastors or priests, whatever, or rabbis, that they get too much in the theology of the thing, which may be a little strange to them both, or too segmented, that they get all mixed up, and it drives them further away or something. And rather than just the simple gospel of Jesus' love, and of course you probably can't bring that in when you have Jewish Protestant, but the other is probably.
It seems like when you bring the churches into it, is when the problems arise. I have a very close friend who's Jewish, and she's very attracted to this guy who is not, and she's afraid she's afraid to let their relationship grow because of, you know, her parents and grandparents and what they'll think, and, you know, just what the whole Jewish family will think. And it just seems like that shouldn't be that. I mean, I get really frustrated, she, you know, when what to tell her, but if it was just her own decision, then, you know, she would let that relationship grow and become closer to this guy. So it just seems when you bring the religions into it, it's when things start getting messed up. I mean, they would, I think, work something out, you know, between them.
I think it depends on how important religion or how important the Lord is in your life.
Mm-hmm.
If he's the most important thing in your life, then a partner, a marriage partner, is one of the most important decisions you'll ever have to make. And you would never marry somebody maybe that wasn't as committed as you or have the same ideas.
Mm-hmm.
To a lot of us, religion is an imperative. I look at myself, and I know I don't even go to a Lutheran church much anymore, but I know that I'm not willing to give up my Lutheran beliefs. And say, if I marry a Catholic, I'd have a real hard time. I know, because I have a lot of that stuff thought out. And I think that might be, it is a family thing, but to say honest Christians, I think it's a theological thing too. What are you willing to give up? Because you have to give in marriage. Give up something. Are you willing to give up imperatives?
I like your introduction of that word, because that's what I see going on for Jerry. It's imperative for him. For his wife, it is not at all. And she looks down on anybody who's dealing with those kind of imperatives. I would imagine at the beginning of their marriage, at the beginning of their relationship, religion was probably not a part of it at all. And but it has become one. It has become a barrier between them. And so we, you know, adjust the fine-tuning down now a little bit and say, what do you do about a situation? Okay, so you make a very wise choice. At the time that the choice is made, you find yourselves really rather identical in terms of commitment, in terms of piety, in terms of deeper understanding of the meaning of the faith in your life. But then things change. Then where are you?
I guess as far as I'm concerned, if that happened in my life, I would have to be faithful, you know, still be committed as much as possible.
To what?
To the other person.
Oh,
to
okay. Praying,
to the Lord too, but to praying for them.
Okay. Because when I look at just, you know, people and they're dealing with the ordinary things of life, I see change. And certainly when I look at people and they're dealing with the faith, I see change. I certainly am, as far as the faith is concerned, I certainly am not the same guy this lady married 24 years ago. I'm not. Am I?
No. Interesting little thing in this children's letters to God, a prayer that a little girl named Nan wrote. Dear God, the people in the next apartment fight real loud all the time. You should only let good friends get married. Nan. And I think John Schramm said last night that the one problem situation was a bad choice. and I think that's part of what we're talking about. In the beginning, you do have some control over the choice, but sometimes you make what appears to be a good choice, and things change over the years, and then what do you do with that? Do you... I think Jerry and Ruth didn't ever deal with their differences. They just fought about them or had them, they hurt each other with them, but they didn't ever try and deal with them. The fact that the church was important to him, 2 years before the youngest child got baptized, all that while they were fussing over whether that youngest child should be baptized or not. And, you know, I think if you can have a good relationship that has differences, either that were there in the beginning or that grew over the years, but you do have to learn to deal with those and not to let them become a source of greater problems. One of those carries over into this next section, and I think we could probably still do that.
Okay.
Wait a minute. Why don't you read it?
Not in this book. Wrong book.
Wrong.
Let me see what I wrote on the page.
What I wanted was the one... Yeah, okay.
Okay, what we have here is differences in feelings, in rather important feelings between people. Ruth, knowing Jerry's contempt for Richard, let me elaborate on that a bit. That Ruth chose to have her affair with Richard could not have been a more appropriate choice. Jerry despised Richard. Richard was everything Jerry looked down on. He was an insensitive, boorish, crude, direct, almost brutal sort of man. He was also kind of a bag of hot air, I think, as I see him. But everything that Jerry despised was epitomized in Richard, and that's the one his wife chooses to have the affair with. Ruth, knowing Jerry's contempt for Richard and his proud passion for himself, felt most faithless when she disclosed not her body, which seemed hers to share, but the private terror Jerry shared only with her. He says he sees death everywhere. This is Ruth now talking to Richard.
About Jerry.
about Jerry. He says he sees death everywhere, in the newspapers, in the grass. He looks at the children and says they're sucking the life out of him. He says there are too many. Has he ever seen a psychiatrist? Richard pinched a slice of water chestnut between his chopsticks and carried it to his mouth. They had reached the Chinese restaurant on a brilliant July day. The curtains of the restaurant were all drawn, making a kind of amber evening out of noon. He despises psychiatry, says Ruth. He hates it if I suggest there's anything abnormal about his state. When I say, I'm not afraid of death, he tells me I'm a spiritual cripple. He says I'm not afraid because I have no imagination. No soul is what I think he means. Richard sipped his martini, his third, and rubbed his mouth with his knuckle. Nice boorish, you know, thing to do. I'd never appreciated how neurotic this guy is. I would have written him off as a simple manic depressive, but this death wish sounds pretty psychotic. Has it affected his work? On and on and on. But you see the difference now of feeling that goes on.
And the fact that Ruth is sharing something that Jerry has said very privately to her. It upsets her. She's bugged by the fact that he's upset with death. But they don't, instead of Jerry and Ruth talking about it, she goes to Richard and says, gee, this is a weird thing. My husband's all obsessed with death. Now, they might have been able to solve that a little bit, the two of them, but they didn't ever talk about things with each other. They just got upset over things. And then she betrays his secrets, the things that he's telling her of his inmost feelings, how awful he feels that he knows that he's going to die. And she goes and tells Richard. That's kind of what I was leading up to before, the fact that they didn't try to work with their differences. They used them as wedges that drove them farther and farther away from each other.
She finds his fear about death to be something that's unacceptable to her. It's weakness. Her father, you will remember, was a very strong man. Strong, self-determined, self-reliant, independent. And now here is this poor husband of hers who gets asthma attacks in the middle of the night and walks around wheezing that he's going to die, and very soon, and preoccupied with death, seeing it everywhere, as she tells Richard. A different attitude, a different feeling. You might even say a difference in makeup between these two, huh? But again, a difference that becomes a barrier between them, and finally for Ruth, a way to really collaborate. She takes his carefully guarded secret and, you know, shows it to this pig Richard, who serves the purpose very well. He's exactly the guy she should tell. Would make her feel better than telling anybody else. Exposing her husband's weakness to him.
It reminds me almost of grade school kids, and you know, and they know something about the other guy, and if they want to hurt him, then they'll go and tell someone else. And, you know, to not hurt the other person is to deal with the problem. To hurt him is to share that problem with a third party who you know would be a problem
mm-hmm.
person.
Do you see the difference in attitude? She really is not afraid of death. It doesn't bother her. I don't know why. There are some people like that, I'm sure. She is afraid, however, of weakness in those around her. She finds weakness very unacceptable. She sees his fear of death as weakness, I think.
I remember when I was really sick, when I was about 30 years old, and you didn't like sickness.
Right.
And he just wanted me to get well, and he wasn't willing in the beginning, when it turned out to be really, really sickness, he got a little more sympathetic, but for a long time he did what he called kicking the pants therapy, and he'd just say, you know, you're okay, just get up, and you know, you're all right, and he really hated sickness in his parents, too. Remember, your father was sick a lot, and he just always thought that was just pretend. And
I was right.
You haven't converted him yet.
But that was a really tough
78
year.
78 going strong.
It was a tough year for us, not just because I was sick, but because you couldn't stand sickness. And, you know, I was almost happy that I was really sick, just because you had to believe it eventually. But no, we made it through that year. I guess we'd make it through anything.
Question occurs to me. You don't have to divulge the end of the plot line or something like that. Is there any eschatology in the hope in either of them? Is the religion hope of us? Do they trust God? That's the first commandment.
Jerry does not trust God very much, I don't think. Jerry's into a kind of, what would you say, do your duty and get your reward sort of religion. Yes. Another thing about Richard that makes him additionally repugnant to Jerry is he's a self-proclaimed atheist.
He's the only one he knows in this whole little town that it actually is self-proclaimed, and that bugs him. And the fact that they've been friends all along is kind of a miracle, because they really aren't very much alike. Yeah. Tomorrow we'll go on with a couple more scenes from Marry Me, but then some other just flat-out differences between people, and talk about living with differences and also when they're impossible living without them.
We don't really have to pay attention to it. The same with Sally and Richard. If asked, another thing about Richard that makes him additionally repugnant to Jerry is he's a self-proclaimed atheist.
He's the only one he knows in this whole little town that it actually is self-proclaimed, and that bugs him. And the fact that they've been friends all along is kind of a miracle, because they really aren't very much alike.
Yeah.
Tomorrow we'll go on with a couple more scenes from Marry Me, but then some other just flat-out differences between people, and talk about living with differences and also when they're impossible living without them.